hello, and welcome to The Collaboration Conversation, a listener-supported video podcast where Christian artists, entrepreneurs, and friends share about their upcoming projects and how they are using the gifts and talents that God has given them. This podcast is only made possible through generous listeners like you, and we are so very grateful for our supporters. If you would like to sponsor an episode, head over to thecollaborationconversation.org and click Sponsor an Episode. Likewise, if you want to check out or support our nonprofit ministry, Project Brickworks, head over to projectbrickworks.org. Today, our very special guest is Josh Walsh. Josh is a film producer and the chief operating officer of Kingdom Story Company. Since joining the Irwin Brothers in 2011, the team has produced an incredible lineup of feature films, including October Baby, Mom's Night Out, Woodlawn, I Can Only Imagine, I Still Believe, and their current film, The Jesus Music. Josh, thank you so much for taking some time to be with us today. We are so grateful.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
It is so nice to meet you. We got to see you in Atlanta at the Christian Worldview Film Festival. Yep. But this is our first time officially meeting. We're so grateful to have you with us.
Of course. That was a fun session. It was just, I was in between marketing the Jesus Music, and I just finished kind of the post-production on it. So it was fun just to kind of get out and talk to people. And I love stuff like what we're doing today and talking to people, because I am and have been that person. You know, I'm constantly looking for ways to learn from listening and reading and hearing people and meeting people. And then I love to kind of pour back into people and tell them, like, okay, this is what I learned by just doing it. You know, it's just part of kind of who I am. I love to just kind of share what I'm learning, you know.
So. Oh my gosh, I love that.
Yeah, we're grateful.
Yeah, we are grateful. You know, we'll talk about talents and gifts later, but I think that's going to be a little bit part of that is how much you care for people and pouring into them. So, yeah. Well, for me and for those who may not know you, will you tell us just a little bit about you and your family?
Yes. Obviously, name is Joshua Walsh, or Josh Walsh. I live in Franklin, Tennessee. I've been married for 5 years to my wife, Abigail, and we have one child, Hugo. He's 5 years old, and he loves movies just as much as I do. He's a big fan of the Jesus Music. He's watched it like a million times.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. One of the funniest things is he was singing all these old CCM songs. So he was like running around our house singing God Gave Rock and Roll to You. And I was like,
this is so You've fun. Raised him well.
I know. And I guess my wife has taught him to call Amy Grant the queen. So anytime he sees Amy Grant, he's like, it's the queen.
Amy. Oh my gosh.
I love Amy Grant. So, he goes, Michael W. Smith has a grandson named Wit, and he loves Wit, and he'll all be like, oh, that's Wit's grandpa. Michael
W. Smith. So funny.
That was our life for 18 months, was all of this. So we were just studying it and delving into it and watching footage and watching edits. So he got to sit there and watch it. And that's kind of one of the things I'm very passionate about in filmmaking and this career I've had, is to involve my family in it, you know, because so much of the entertainment business is about tearing families apart. Mm. So as long as I'm in it and trying to make it work and make a difference in it, I'm going to include my family in that, because we want to model out that it can work, you know? We're trying anyway.
We'll I love that. That's beautifully said. That's awesome.
Thanks. All right. So you've been involved with a lot of great Christian films and faith-based films, but we want to start with The Jesus Music.
Which is what
I just saw.
It just came out.
Oh my gosh. Loved it. Well, and you said that when we met in that line briefly, I said that's what just inspired me to come up here and just kind of out of the blue, just like, would you be on our podcast?
Pretty please.
And you said yes. But can you just talk about your inspiration for that and just how it started and all that?
Yeah, so 18 months ago, a little bit over that, you know, right after we released a movie called I Still Believe in Theaters, we released it Friday, March 13th.
Yes, I remember. I saw it that day. And then
did you? Yeah, well, I'm grateful you did, because there was a lot of people that did see it in those 3 days.
Yep.
And then the world ended. And so we had 3 days in theaters. I remember, you know, Friday for a movie opening is always a scary day. Mm. Anyway. And it's like hourly, you're watching things and you're doing math and you're trying to figure out how well this thing's going to do. And to have a Friday on the Friday that we had it.
Oh my word.
Yeah. So it was like, we're sitting there and it's like, oh, Disney World shut down. Great. And they're like, well, Mulan's not going to push. And Mulan pushes. And then everything pushes. And then by Monday, movie theaters are all shut down.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there like, oh, man, God, what do we do now? Yeah. You know, like the rest of the world. Not
right.
Just us.
That's true.
You know?
Right.
Yes. But, you know, we, you know, it was a funny time because you're just so, okay, what are we going to do? You know, how are we going to, like, survive? And what kinds of products can we do? All our movies got shut down. We were about to produce 2 movies. They were getting, you know, one was like 6 weeks away from filming, and it all got shut down.
Yeah.
And we all sat there and we said, what do we do now? And so we were just kind of brainstorming, and I went back that night and I watched this documentary, a musical documentary, and it just hit me. I'm like, so interesting. No one's ever told the story of Christian contemporary music. And obviously at this point we're trying to figure out what we can do production wise because you can't go shoot a feature film because it's just impossible at that point. But you could do documentaries.
You could do interviews. Yeah.
And I love documentaries. It's one of my favorite parts of filmmaking. And I watched this doc and it was a musical doc. And I thought, you know, how cool would it be to see a documentary about the history of Christian music? Because I love Christian music. I've been a part of it in all these different capacities with our films.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you guys have a theme lately.
We've done, you know, 2 features on Christian musicians.
Yeah.
One, I Can Only Imagine, which was the most successful of our films. Beyond that, I have an interesting connection to Christian music. My parents were, right after they got saved, they went to a Keith Green reunion concert. So for your listeners who might not know, Keith Green died in a plane wreck. Or plane crash in the 80s, in 1982, I believe. And he had this whole concert schedule, this whole tour. And they were partnering with Youth with the Mission, and it was going to be this, like, kind of big tour where they got all these missionaries to go out because Keith had asked the head of YWAM, and he said, you know, what do you need? And they said, missionaries. And he said, well, I'm going to make that the theme of my tour, you know. Mm-hmm. So he books this whole tour out,
yeah.
And then he dies in a plane crash. It was very tragic. It rocked the Christian community. And
it
the
did. Community. Yeah.
Huge. A lot of people can remember, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
So they, Melody, I mean, a few months after her husband dies in a plane crash, she decides she's going to go and do the tour dates anyway and play this footage from the last concert that Keith did. And they were going to preach and they were going to try to get people to go to the mission field. Well, my parents were like newly saved and they were following Keith. And then he died. It was like a big blow to him. So they went to the reunion tour. They never actually seen him live, and they like heard Jesus Commands You to Go, and they, which was one of Keith's songs, they were like, you know what, we should go. And so they went on the mission field for 7 years. So I was raised listening to Jesus music in
the background.
Keith Green and Love Song and Second Chapter of Acts, and these were bands that I listened to because my parents weren't big modern day CCM fans, but they were big about this, like that era of the 70s. So I got to listen to that music, and Keith Green was one of my like favorite, like my inspirations. I love Keith Green.
Yeah.
Still to this day, I think it holds up, and I've read No Compromises book and stuff. And then skip, you know, ahead, I got to be a part of the movie I Can Only Imagine, and then I got to be a part of the movie I Still Believe. And then we were about to shoot a movie called Jesus Revolution, which was all about the birth of the Jesus movement in Southern California and the music and all the things that came along with it. So I had kind of these different parts of the story, and I thought, man, has anyone done this? So I went on this search and I looked, and nobody really had ever done anything like it. And there wasn't even really books that existed out there that had told that story. So I just thought, man, let's do a mini series, like, and shoot it and then pitch to Netflix and we'll sell it. It'll be great. So we went out and shot 100 interviews.
Oh my gosh.
Wow. Well,
Amy Grant and Michael W. Smith came on board as producers for it, really like bought into it, which allowed us to kind of have the credibility with the artist to say, hey, listen, yes, Michael and Amy did this first. So, you know,
yeah.
And it was amazing. And we had so many of these artists come on board, and then we did put together a pitch video, went up to Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, and everyone was like, eh. And I was devastated.
Oh no.
Like, you know, because they were just kind of like, ah, oh, well, it's kind of interesting, you know. I don't know too much about this Christian music thing. Is the audience big? Does anybody really care? You know. And I was so devastated. I thought, man, this is the end of, you know, this. And so, you know, I said, they said that on Imagine, you know, we had a lot of people turn down Imagine. So I just went, you know, let's just do it. We know the audience is there. We know that we can do this well. So let's pivot to a feature film and just make it and get it out there. And so we did. We raised the money independently. and we did it all ourselves. And so that movie came out 3 weeks ago, I think. Yeah. Now 3 weeks ago. And it's done great. And it's been, you know, a lot of the industry has been, you know, very impressed by it. Hollywood's been, you know, what in the world? Why? How did this movie end up doing this well? This is a documentary in the middle of the pandemic about
Christian yes, people. Yeah, you know,
yeah. It was really a great experience, and so it was really fun to be the kind of the person shepherding that process. I got to learn. You know, I had that base understanding, but I had to like delve into it and really learn all this history and read all these obscure books and watch interviews and shoot interviews and talk to people. And it was really kind of fun way to discover a history of something. By making a doc about it.
Oh my gosh. That's awesome.
It was fun.
Is this your first time to kind of shepherd it, like you said?
I've been a part of producing in some capacity.
Right.
About 11 or 12 feature films. You know, this is the first time I helmed a project as the producer.
Wow.
Yes. So I have been a producer, you know, so, you know, there's always like three or four producers.
Right.
So my role with John and Andy started 11 years ago with their first film, October Baby.
Yeah,
they actually gave me a producer credit on it. I probably didn't really deserve it, but I kind of came on and volunteered for the project and just did whatever they needed. And it was like a less than $1 million budget. And then I stayed with them on through and I just kind of did anything they needed me to do. And I found I gravitated towards the business and the operations of their company. Right. So because I knew nobody else really wanted to do it, and I thought maybe I could learn and be okay at it. So that's where I focused my time. And on the films, I would wear kind of a production producer hat and help assist the other producers on set to make the thing almost like a community organizer
yeah.
on some, and then a fundraiser on others. And then, you know, I did extras on every one of their movies, which is a funny little thing. I did.
That's a big job.
It's a thankless job.
It really is.
And it's funny. It's like, it follows you around. It's kind of like crime. You can't ever shake it. Once you're really good at doing it, people are always like, hey, can you help? Just like, we just got like one scene with like 1,000 people. Can you get
oh gosh. Oh my gosh. You just like made my heart sink. I would be so, if someone asked me that, I was like, yes.
Sorry. My biggest scene, I had about 4,000 extras in. So.
Holy Toledo.
You watch I Still Believe. There's this one.
Yeah. The big crowd.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that's
insane. It's always so hard for me too, because I don't even appreciate it. I'll watch a movie and I won't even think about how big the crowd is. Like, you know, but when you're doing it, you're like, you watch the movie you did, and you're like, oh my gosh, I got all those people out. Doesn't anybody care?
Doesn't anybody care that they look great and it's because of me?
I still think, even though I had that many in I Still Believe. You know, there was 100 concert shots in that movie, right? So it was like concert.
Right.
It's still my favorite scene and still like one of the hardest scenes to get people to. And what ended up being a really kind of gratifying moment was the last scene in the movie, I Can Only Imagine. So there was the last scene of that movie was the last day of filming. We were completely out of money, so there was no way to get it if we messed it up.
Oh, gosh. And
it was an ice storm in Oklahoma City. I've been working for the whole shoot towards this one scene, and I've been marketing and working in the community and working with churches and just trying to get people to the scene. And it was a 2,500 seat auditorium. And I was like, I got, this is like, if you read the script and you watch the movie, it's like the crescendo of the
it
movie.
Is. Yes.
Finally opens his mouth and sings this song. So my wife was very pregnant, and she had her son a couple of days before that scene. So I was exhausted and tired because it was like a rough birth. And then I come out of that kind of ready to get this final scene. And it, like, I look at the weather and it's like all the news and it's like terrible. And so we're like, we're thinking we're screwed. Like,
yeah.
I'm on set that day, and I was talking to my wife, and I was like, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if anybody's going to show up. I was like, I hope at least a couple hundred people show up so that we can put them next to the stage.
Right, yeah, right in the front.
Feel full.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe CGI and find the money. I don't know.
Yeah.
Money for it. And would you believe there was probably 10, maybe 20 empty seats in a 2,500 seat arena? So many people showed up. I never had that many people. Like,
yay, God.
It actually had to shut the scene down. We had to stop filming because it took so long to sit everybody that came. And it was just amazing. And you feel it. You like it's one of those things that you feel you might not, like, if you watch that scene, you might go, oh, it's just well shot and it's such a beautiful moment. But there are things about a scene like that where you feel it and you can feel that scene, you know, and it helps the actors too, because they like kind of feel it, like, I mean, it's a full house. So it was a special night for sure.
That is so cool. I got chills. Oh, yay, God.
Gosh. Yes.
Yay, the God. Best
part, and I'll tell you, this was my favorite part of the whole night. So at like some, you know, this is, you know, if you've been on a film set, this is how it goes. They, you know, there was a union break for lunch at like, they say it messes with your head, at like 10 o'clock, 10 p.m. Ugh. So everybody stops and they have to feed everybody, right?
Right.
So we had, not the extras they had eaten before and stuff, because they're on normal human time schedules. it's like, so ridiculous. They're like, stop for lunch. It's 10 o'clock. You're like, what in the world?
What?
You know, and I was really afraid we were going to lose people because we had more shots to do. So they said, yeah, we can lose like half of them, but try to keep people. And I was like, I don't know if people are going to stay. We had like 700 people stay. And we were like, what are we going to do with them? We have an hour. So we actually, like, it, like, one of the guys that co-wrote the film was a worship leader. And he just started playing piano. We actually did a concert. And then Jay Michael, who played Bart, came back out and sang. And it was just a special moment. And everybody was singing along. It was like a worship service in the middle.
Oh, my gosh.
Making a movie. I was like, it was probably my favorite day of ever being on a film set. You know, because we were just like, it just felt very special and unified, you know.
So, yes.
Well, movie was. Oh, I love that.
Well, and that's what music does.
Yeah.
It brings people together. It's unifying. Yeah. And that I would say that movie sets and movie productions are funny. If they're toxic on set, you feel it in the movie. You know, mm-hmm. even people have good intentions. I've been on films where it was like, oh, we're going to make a great movie. Everyone's, you know, but it got toxic on set and there was problems. You feel it when you finally watch the movie. And when there's unity on set and when people are actually like, are really working well together and, you know, you can feel that. It's weird.
you know?
But it's so true. It's so true.
The screen.
Wow.
It's so true.
Yeah.
Well, you kind of already touched on this a little bit, but one of our questions was, what was some of the biggest challenges to get this movie made? You mentioned talking about Jesus music. You mentioned that you had pitched it to several networks. Would you say that is the biggest hurdle you had getting it made? Was it COVID? Were there other hurdles?
A lot of challenges to make this movie. You know, it felt like every day was a challenge. I thought you just always think something's going to be easier before you do it. And then it's a lot harder than you ever imagined.
So true.
Yeah.
In some ways, we were so blessed by how much favor we had throughout the whole process.
Okay.
But in other ways, we, you know, it was very challenging. You know, so the first challenge was really getting all the interviews and getting the right interviews. So, you know, convincing people that this is something you want to do. And it's not to cast judgment on anyone. It's just in this day and age, there's so many documentaries that are hit pieces and, you know, and you know, only have so much time. And it's not like you're paying people to be in documentaries, you know, usually they're doing it, and especially in ours, that everybody did it gratis. You know, so you're trying to convince someone to give us 3 hours of your time to talk about something, to be a part of it. You know, so it's just it's a balancing act.
Yeah.
The major challenges for Jesus Music. Yeah. The how to get it paid for and out and distributed was big. You know, I had never, you know, we had done so much independent stuff. I'd never really gone and pitched to networks, and I didn't understand how streaming and all that worked. So it was very scary to kind of go in there and pitch to those streamers.
Yeah.
And it was hard to hear, you know, people not think it was worth, you know, putting out there, you know, especially when you see all the garbage that's being put out all over.
Twitter. Right. So true. Oh, yes. Yeah.
This is going to be so great for your audience, and this is going to be big. And it, you know, it was hard to hear that. You know, it never stopped us really in the past, because we've always kind of been our own kind of men.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
That was a challenge. I think we had to navigate. There were some challenges I never thought would be so challenging. Again, we were really blessed. But you know, when you're making a documentary, you don't think about all of the archival and the music that goes into it. Apparently, every producer forgets about it, so I don't feel too bad. But you get to the end, and you got to like document all that stuff, and you got to get, you know, if you get fair use, you have to have a fair use thing, and it's a big old process.
Yeah,
you know, our doc, there was 1,000 pieces of archival, 1,000.
Holy!
And you
got to
track every single one of those things in a spreadsheet, and you got to get like, you got to have a reason why it's fair use, and if you don't have a reason it's fair use, you have to have it licensed, and you got to go license it. The most obscure one I found was the guy that shot the Time magazine front covers and the Life magazine covers of all the Expo 72 stuff. I found him. He was like in San Antonio. He was 97 years old. And I got him on the phone and I like, please, can I use your photographs in our doc? And he's like, yeah, yeah, sure.
Oh, like, sure. Yay.
I know. It was cool.
That is cool.
So, stuff like that, like, and there were so many of those things because a doc, like a movie, you know, like the one I'm working on right now, you have a script, right? Mm-hmm. And you get that script right. And then everybody looks at a script and they're all following the script. Right. And then, right. And if something's off, they go, hey, that's not what was in the script. Or I thought right. This is what it was supposed to look like in the script. A documentary, you can write a script, but really it's about discovery. And it's like, you could take it 100 million different ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
The first huge challenge for us was how do you even take the story of Christian music and whittle it down to an hour and a half to an hour and 40 minutes, because it's such a big subject. And so how do you do that in a way that's entertaining? Who do you include? Who's not good? How do you mitigate everybody being offended at you? How do you make it entertaining? How do you make it compelling? It's like, that was a monster task. And we worked on it for probably edited straight for a year with at 1.5, 6 editors.
Wow.
Oh my goodness.
Well, you all did a great job at being so inclusive. So many people were in that. I love the striper section. I mean,
that was not awesome.
Yes, I learned so much. That was great.
That was my favorite section.
Was it?
It was because it was so. This was something that John Irwin, who directed on it, really did a great job, in my opinion. I watched a couple docs recently that came out that were very one tone throughout the whole doc. It was like either really heavy or very emotional, and it's like the entire time. And you really don't want to have an experience like that the entire time, because one, it takes away from the emotional moments. So you got to have some highs and lows and fun and scare. You got to go through all these like emotions. And I think the filmmakers did such a good job on it that we worked with of kind of telling a thematic emotional story throughout the whole thing. So the striper section for a couple minutes kind of gives you the permission to laugh a little bit.
Yes.
And to let loose and just kind of embrace the crazy of the 80s. And
it's that tension break. We love tension breaks.
We were laughing the whole time. Not at Striper. Striper's actually a pretty fantastic band.
Yes.
The funniness of the 80s, man. It was just so outlandish. And the funny things that Joel Smallbone said and John Cooper said, it allowed the audience to kind of like laugh for a second, especially coming out of the 70s where it was so moving and you were so emotional and you're like watching these baptisms, and it just allowed you to kind of kick back and laugh for a second.
Yeah.
Which was fun. And then the finding the photos of Striper was like one of my favorite things ever. Was we were like the video, the photos, discovering that stuff was so fun because they were just, every time you found like a treasure trove of that stuff, you were like, I would come in and be like, guys, you won't believe what I found, So
that's awesome.
That is so cool.
Well, if I could go back in time, which I cannot, I would volunteer to be a research assistant for you.
Oh man.
I would have loved that.
You know what? There's a big need for it in the world. So, I think we're going to do that at some point.
We love it. That's awesome. So,
What's funny is it can always be a second career. And by the way, it's needed because it's a really hard thing to do. There's this whole career of people that are archivalists and archival researchers. And I would do it too. I love it. I have a lot of fun doing it. And just kind of finding, there's all these like archival sites. And then if you go real nerdy, you go like the Library of Congress and scan photos. It's fun stuff.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
But I'd only want to do it for this topic.
Yeah. She's like, only this one. This is it.
I can't think of another topic.
That's so funny.
We end up doing a series, which I hope we do someday, with the stuff we shot. The goal is to do a feature, get people interested in the series. I will call you.
And good to know. There you go.
I'm right around the corner.
Yeah, that's right.
That would be great. She
literally is around the corner. That's funny.
That'd be awesome.
Well, so we talked a little bit earlier about how on all of the different films you guys have made over the years, you've worn several hats, but that this was like the first one that you like took on the helm producer role. So I just kind of want to talk to you a little bit about each of the films and kind of what your roles were and what you learned and what you found you didn't like, what you did like. So I thought we'd just start with October Baby. And like work our way,
because my whole life is in 2-year increments with films. Like I'll always be like, that was turning out Mom's Night Out, right? That's how I think of time. So
yeah. Well, so tell me about October Baby. What did you learn? What did you do?
I learned everything because it was my first feature. I was literally a volunteer on it. I learned that on that film that film sets are problem factories, you know, and if you love to problem solve, that's the place.
It's a good place for you.
Mm-hmm. Everything is like crammed in. Like, think about like a company and all the problems that happen in a year span of a normal company. Now take that and shove it into 30 days.
Yeah.
For real.
Yeah. So it's everything is urgent because everything is immediate. Mm-hmm. I remember a line producer on a movie once telling me, you know, hey, listen, this film set is costing us $100,000 a day. So that means, you know, for every hour costs $10,000 or whatever, and every 30 minutes is this. And he did the math on it, like, because he was a line producer. And I was so stressed out by the end of it. I'm like, oh my gosh, if I like mess up the set by 30 minutes, I'm going to cost them $10,000 or something. And it's so true because it's so quick. You know, you have a short amount of days, even a long film, like, even when you hear about like film sets that are like 40 days of filming, when you really watch, like, it's when you live through it, it's not very long. It's not very long. You always have no time. So, and our movies, I mean, I think October Baby was like 20 days, you know, it was like a really short shoot.
Yeah.
I learned like, okay, I like to solve problems, and this is rampant with problems. So I remember, you know, that was where I first learned, like, you know, one of the principles that I always try to pull to teach people that are getting into film, which is learn to serve, you know, like, which is, you know, I know it's cliche, but it's so key, because if you learn to serve and you have a servant's heart, you know, you will thrive in this environment because it's very easy to bring value if you're serving people. And so I always say, like, try to figure out how to bring value and have a service mindset. And I learned that on that film.
Yes.
You know, so I just went, what does nobody want to do? And everyone's like, nobody wants to do the extras because it's the worst job ever. And I was like, okay, I'll do that.
Yeah. You know?
And they were like, oh, fine, you do it. And a lot of the guys that I started with are in film and I'm still working because I decided to serve and try to bring value. So, you know, everybody wants to do the fun jobs, you know, but sometimes, you know, that's not where the opportunity is.
Yeah.
So I got the opportunity on that one to serve in that way, because I remember them talking about a big scene in the movie and they're like, you know, we don't know how we're going to fill this big, you know, theater. And, you know, maybe we'll use cutouts of cardboard. And
I was like, you said, I got this.
Well, you know, what's funny about it, it's not the hardest job in the world. Everybody wants to be in a movie.
Yeah,
you
know, that's true.
Just got to get in front of them. Just got to sign them up. Just got to organize it. So
I
did that. And then they afterwards, because of it, I almost got like an honorary producer credit. They gave me an associate producer credit for my like effort on the film.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
And I learned like, okay, this is something I like. And if you like to solve problems, and I learned that if you have a value mindset, you know, you can really serve a production.
I love that. Oh my gosh.
So good.
So cool. Okay. Well, what about Mom's Night Out, which I love. I'm a huge Grey's Anatomy fan. So as soon as I saw that she was going to be in that, I was like, well, I'm there. Okay, great.
She's great. And she's fantastic.
Yeah.
On Mom's Night Out, I learned that no matter how hard of a worker you are and no matter how talented you are, you need a team.
Mm.
You know, so I burnt myself out really bad on that movie. And everything worked, but at the end of it, I realized I could have done this with a team and I didn't, you know, and because of that, I was, you know, I had to shoulder everything myself and I burnt myself out and I was just trying to like be a hero and prove to everyone that, but at the end of the day, if you have a great team, you can do more and not die.
And not be dead by the end of it and not be burned out.
What was your role in that?
I got a co-producer credit.
Okay, good.
Mom's Night Out, and I did. I did a lot of volunteer work in the community. Got the community kind of rallied up behind the film. Helped with stunts, a big stunt sequence. And I did a lot of just producing.
That's awesome.
Whatever was needed, I jumped in and did. So a lot of sometimes my approach to filmmaking is almost like the Rodriguez list. I go out there and I just try to figure out what do they need. You know,
what so
it's
need?
Like, hey, we need cars. I mean, like. For Moms and Out was the funniest bunch of stuff. Like there was a scene they needed 80 bikers for. So I networked with all the biker ministries in the world and had like 180 like bikers show up, you know.
That is so funny.
It was just kind of fun jobs too. I always thought it would be funny, you know, or there was like a stunt sequence that needed like volunteer people in vehicles, but they needed to be trained for weeks, you know, before they were in it. And I enlisted people for that. Or background extras, or, you know, finding locations, you know, just stuff like that. I would, you know, or RVs for the set, you know. I was like, I bet you could find an RV company and put their name in the credits and they would give it for a discounted rate.
Sure enough.
Oh, I love that.
It definitely sounds like you needed a team from all of the things you just listed.
Yeah, I did that mostly by myself. There was one day on Mom's Night Out where I was, and this is dangerous, and you know, I was being an idiot. But I remember driving home because it was called Mom's Night Out, which we all learned is a terrible idea because when you're shooting a film at night, you typically need, you know, to shoot like
at night,
the length of a day. So you would start at 6 p.m. and shoot till 6 a.m. for weeks.
Yep.
Oh, and can't the trouble imagine.
When you do the job that I do is that the rest of the world isn't awake all night. So you got to do your work during the day.
Wow. And
then at night, you're on working set. As well.
Yeah.
So you sleep, you know. Jeez. And so that one was so hard. One day I had I had worked it during the day trying to get a bunch of people and things for a scene. Then I worked all night. Then I worked another day. Mm. And I never slept. And I was driving home, and this is the most tired I've ever been in my life. I was driving, and I literally, like, kind of stopped, and you know, I was driving along, and I realized I don't know where I am, day it is, where I'm going,
right?
You know, I was just
yikes.
I was entirely blank, and I went, okay, you're gonna kill yourself doing this.
Like, yes,
you're gonna crash your car. You're gonna die. You're like you're trying to prove yourself so badly.
Yeah.
That you're gonna hurt yourself, you know. So I went home and I went to sleep. So,
good.
As well, you should have. And now you learned you need a team and you deserve to have a team.
That's right.
Teamwork so makes the dream work, Josh.
I build the biggest team on the film.
I believe it.
Before any project I work on, I end up with the biggest team, even when it doesn't start that way. Now I'm just like, you know what? Enough of that crap. It's more fun too, because you get to be with people and I had like a team of like, I swear there would have been like 15 people on my team before the end of it. Cause I'd get all these people to work on the scenes, and I'd get volunteers, and I just had an army of people, and I've done that ever since. And it's so much fun. It's one of my favorite things to do.
And working with a team, it really makes it special, right? You build these relationships and you build, especially in filmmaking, you build your network and your tribe. And like, those are the people you're going to call movie after movie. It's You're so keeping people fun. Employed. I mean, you know.
Yeah, and it's so fun to work with people and to bring people in. I love to bring people in from outside the film industry to kind of learn.
Yeah.
People are interested in it. So I had so much fun. Woodlawn was the next film I worked on.
Yeah, that was my next question. So.
Yeah, that was the biggest film I had worked on. You know, and on that one, we had a financing issue halfway through, which is like the death nail of independent film. You never want to run out of set money while you're on set. And we had almost that happen, you know? And so I just, you know, kind of maintained that attitude of look for what nobody else can do or was wanting to do. And fundraising is really hard, you know? And so I saw an opportunity where I thought, hey, I don't know if I'm good at this, but I'm going to try it, you know? And so, you know, I was working with John Irwin, who was directing the movie, and trying to fundraise for it while doing that. And I went, he's going to die.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I was like, wow. You know what? I built a team because I learned about teams.
Good job.
So I hope that team can go and actually manage all the stuff that I'm managing. And I'm going to focus on something new, which was this fundraising and on the business side. I never raised money for anything before. And I just jumped into it, and I had that same, how can I bring value and how can I serve the production, and ended up raising a lot of money for the film with John and a team. And it was really fun. And I learned through that, like, oh, I can raise money, and I can learn this business side of it. And I actually really enjoy that side, which is the economic side of filmmaking and the business side of filmmaking. And that's, it was kind of shortly after that movie that John said, why don't you run the business side?
Wow.
Focus on the creative side.
That's awesome.
I did.
I love that.
He also knows to build a strong team around him as well. Yeah. And you're part of that.
Oh yeah. John was a great mentor throughout this whole, my whole career. He's always pushed me outside of my comfort zone, which is always a good thing. You know, like in any jump in life, he's always said, I think you can do this. You should try it. And you know, if you fail, you're going to learn.
You'll learn something. That's awesome.
That's very cool.
That's great. Okay. Well, so the next one I've got is I Can Only Imagine. We talked about extras on that last day, but what else can you tell us about what you learned and what you did on that film?
Imagine is where I learned that the culture of your set can actually affect the final product. Mm. You know, because you kind of, it's crazy when you're a filmmaker and you look at the final product in a theater with everybody sitting there and you think, nobody knows everything that happened behind us. It's like the tip of the iceberg is the product, and underneath it is all this effort and work and drama and chaos and messiness that it takes to make a movie. I actually wrote that down in my journal after Imagine kind of did very successful in the box office. I wrote down, success is kind of messy sometimes in film.
Yeah, it's true.
Because it was just as much of a train wreck as any of our projects were, and it worked. You know, and so that's all people will look at. But, you know, the behind it was 1,000 little, you know, decisions and mistakes and things. But I learned on that, you know, the culture of your film set can actually affect the picture, you know, which is such. So we had such a good culture on it, I Can Only Imagine, because we just came off a movie called Woodlawn, which Woodlawn was not as healthy of a culture on set. And it wasn't, and that kind of kind of went throughout the whole process. Now the movie was a good movie. I ultimately liked it a lot, but it did affect the team. And I don't know if God blessed it as much. And I'm not saying that was the only reason that he did bless it or that's all tied. I don't know. You'll have to talk to someone more theological than me, but there was definitely a humility to our team when we approached I Can Only Imagine, because we had just come off something that wasn't necessarily a perceived hit, you know, and it was kind of, it did okay. We never had a total failure, but it wasn't necessarily a total, you know, like it was kind of middle ground, and we were really disappointed because we had promised kind of the world, you know, to people, and it didn't turn out that way.
Yeah.
And so there was a humility going into I Can Only Imagine, and there was this unity on set of people just kind of going, you know what, we're here for each other. We're not going to stab each other out in the back. We're going to fix problems. You know, we started each day with like a devotional on set, and that was really cool. And we just had this kind of humility about making this movie, like, hey, we might not get to make another one of these, but we do get to make this one. So let's like try to do it the right way.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Every step of that project from idea to screen, it worked kind of like that, you know? And I think ultimately God blessed it because there was unity and there was humility. And I think that was key to the success of it. So that's absolutely something that I've been chasing ever since on every project. I just want to get back to that kind of atmosphere.
I love that.
Well, I would agree. Just having sat in a theater to watch it on opening weekend, it did come through. I mean, I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
And it's funny. I don't, you know, I only have my experience from working on film sets, but I tend to think that's the way it works. Jesus Music was like that, even though it was really hard. The team was unified, and there was a sweetness to the group, and there was a humility.
Yay.
And you see that I think you see that in the product. The end product. That was the lesson I learned on that one.
Yeah,
for awesome. Sure. Okay. And then I Still Believe. What was kind of your major role on that?
I also was a producer on that one. Okay. So, you know, helped kind of do the same thing, you know, on that one that I've done on a lot of them, which is kind of cold, you know, garnering kind of almost this like community organizer worldwide, get the community together, get them excited about the movie, and then work to try to help the production alleviate stress by, you know, just getting them stuff they need.
Yeah.
You know, producing on that one was a challenge because we were in the middle of launching a new business, which was Kingdom. And at the same time making a new movie with a studio. We had never done Mom's Night Out was a studio film with Sony Affirm, but Lionsgate was the first time we were making a studio film in a studio partnership that.
You know? Right.
And it was different, you know, because we were learning a lot. The lesson learned on that one, I'm trying to think of a good lesson.
Well, I know one.
Yes, please.
Don't open on a weekend when there's going to be a pandemic.
How did you not foresee that?
I know, predict that.
That is definitely the takeaway.
I'm kidding. I was kidding.
And don't shoot a movie in Mobile, Alabama in the summer. It's so fucking hot.
Yes. That is a very good takeaway that everyone should take away.
In some ways, I still believe it was fun because I got to take everything I'd learned over the last 10, 11 years and just implement it. And it was almost easy in a way because it was just so much of, it was so much of the stuff I had learned, and it was nothing too challenging. What I would say that what I learned on that one is to include my family, because that one I did include my family in a bigger way than I had in the past. And I really made sure that like we had a good home that we were staying in during there, and I involved them in the production, and they were part of it all. And it was more fun to do well or to be experienced that together. And so I definitely had this like mentality, like, you know what, we're here, we're going to enjoy this area, we're going to enjoy our time together. And it made the experience good for me,
nice,
and my family. So that was one I think I learned, like, I'm going to make sure going forward to prioritize my family in the process instead of just alienating them and focusing on finishing the product.
Well, and I'm sure that they're going to have fond memories of that film because of that as well. Your family.
It's some of our favorite times. It's like the reason I'm excited to go do this movie I'm about to do, because it's in the same area. And we had such a good time as a family in that area during that time. And we had such nice memories that we always think back on it like it was a very sweet time for us.
And hopefully, well, I know you're not filming in the summer, so well done on learning that and taking that to heart.
Never again.
We're filming in December and January. And that's it.
We'll probably be January, February. So, yeah.
That's awesome. That's pretty cool. Well, so you mentioned it a few minutes ago, but in 2018, you guys had the new venture with Lionsgate, where you created a new company called Kingdom Story Company. And I wanted to talk to you about what that was like and, you know, the difference. You kind of talked about how it is different to make a studio film versus an independent film. And so just what that transition has been like for you guys.
It was surreal. It was really surreal. You know, we were peddlers of hope for so long, one day we're going to have a hit movie. I promise, you know, like it's going to be amazing. And then it came and I was like, oh, you know, it actually can happen.
Right.
I did not believe it. After you've gone through, at that point, we had done three or four movies. I had worked on five or six movies, and none of them were hit movies. You know, they were, some of them did well, and they made, you know, and every step we kept growing our business and stuff, but a hit movie is entirely different, you know? And I can only imagine was actually the number one independent film of 2018, the highest grossing independent film of 2018.
That's incredible.
Congratulations. That's awesome.
Yeah, it ended up doing like $86 million in theatrical box office and a lot more even on the Windows after that, and DVD and stuff. It was a huge hit.
Yes.
And it was remarkable. It took us all by surprise. I think I would have thought that I would have been celebrating if it was a $50 million movie. You know, that would have been huge. We had our highest grossing movie prior to that was $14.5 million.
Oh my God. You just blew it out of the water.
Yeah, it was like hockey stick growth. And it really put us on the map. We didn't really know anybody in Hollywood at that point. I remember where like the meetings that we'd be bragging to ourselves about with. Now I look back and go, that's actually kind of funny that we were even like I think at one point on Woodlawn we had met with Relativity, which was this studio that eventually went bankrupt for embezzling money and stuff. And we were like, oh man, we're in a real Hollywood studio. I mean, you look now, it's like, no, when you look back, that was actually kind of a C-level studio. You know, it was not even like.
Yeah.
Really, but, you know, it's interesting. One of the conclusions I had on that is, and I was just talking to someone last night about this, a filmmaker. You know, you kind of realize, yes, it's neat to get on the other side of it and, you know, have done a studio deal and are working with a big studio who's funding your content and is behind you. It makes you feel a little bit like less like a faker, except for the first like year when you're working.
You're in total imposter syndrome. You're like, oh gosh.
Oh yeah. To the next level. You know, you're sitting in meetings and they're like saying things and you're like, yes, that thing. So just to be clear though, what is that thing again? Like, that you're talking about? You just don't know.
You know,
from making independent films to working with studios, and there's all these ways they work, and we're all just like, Yeah.
Whatever you say. Yep. That sounds great. I know what that is.
That's Everybody funny. Has imposter syndrome. But you know, at the end of the day, all that matters in that world for them is there are businesses. They're just businesses. They're the business of butts and seats when it's when for theatrical releases, you know, that's all they care about.
Yeah.
How many people do you get to the movie? When it comes to DVD, how many DVDs did it move? You know, it gets, you know, that's truly when you get past all of the Hollywood, you know, dreams come true stuff, you kind of get to the other side of it. And it's just a bunch of
businessmen, you
know, executives trying to sell some CDs and DVDs. And
yeah,
you know, for us, of course, it's a higher calling, you know, and we have a higher purpose in the work we do. But I think it's good to have that perspective sometimes, because you go in there and you go, you know what? I'm here because I've been called to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And we know how to reach our audience, and we know that we've been called to do this, and that's what we know how to do. And they're not doing that. So you don't have to feel like a faker, you know, because ultimately, you know, I think that's where you just got to check your motives and why you want to do what you do, because you might, you know, have an opportunity to stand before kings, you know, like and work in a, something like that, or you might be peddling it out there and it's not as big of a deal. And if your heart's in the right place, you're okay with both, you know? So for us, it was a neat experience, and it's been a neat experience to learn what it's like to work in a big studio, and it's made us more professional, and we've learned a lot of stuff. Not too much has changed, you know, from the approach we have to making the movies. What's cool is, what keeps us humble is, you know, when we did Imagine, we raised every bit of money for it to make it, to market it. We did not have a studio behind us. We were in a basement in a house in Birmingham, Alabama, which isn't the epicenter for creativity. you know, just not, you know, and we made a movie there. That was the number one, we made a movie without the smartest people in the business telling us how to make it, you know, like Jerry rig it to be successful. We just did what we felt God called us to do. And we did our thing, and it ended up being very successful. And because of that, we get to stand before all these people and get to have these partnerships. So if anybody's listening and they're like, you know, they're coming with an idea and they think, oh, I got to have these people speak into it, I don't know what I'm doing. We didn't know what we were doing. I promise you, we did not know what we were doing. But God blessed it. And had the opportunity, and still have the opportunity because of that product. So I'm always trying to remind everybody in this office and this company that's what matters, you know, like, so stick to that. Don't get so consumed with the, you know, we get to talk to people that other people can't talk to, or we're in a studio and we're cool and we're awesome and we've arrived. That stuff is what will distract you and will cause you not to make the work that we were called to do in the first place. And if it ever becomes that we can't do that where we're at, then we should abandon that, you know, and go back to what God's called us to do and be faithful.
Yes, and amen.
Amen.
If you don't know, our podcast and the ministry that we've created is called Project Brickworks, and it's based on this idea that God has given us unique talents and giftings, and with that comes responsibility, and we're responsible for building our brick in collaboration with Him, using those talents and gifts for this brick that He's going to use to build His kingdom. Yes. And so we love talking to people about their talents and gifts. And sometimes they get a little bit shy and they don't want to talk about themselves because they feel like it's, you know, they're being proud, but we just really want to encourage people that by naming it, we're really giving credit to the Creator and the person who gave you that talent, you know, the God who gave you that talent. Right. And so, I have seen at least three different talents that I, through this interview, that I would like to name for you, but I want to first see if you'll name them for yourself. What are your talents and your gifts?
So what's interesting, I love this conversation, and I absolutely agree with you that, you know, ultimately all your gifts are given to you by the Creator. And if you, you've probably known immensely talented people in your life, they always have these gaping holes in their like talents. And I think that's because God doesn't allow anybody to have all the talents, you know?
Yeah.
Because He wants us all, because ultimately He wants us to work together, I believe. Because
yes.
So you'll have someone, and I've known some incredibly talented people that are just so bad at something that it's laughable, you know? And it's, and I always see that as like God just keeping them humble.
Yep. So, I love that.
Nobody's got it all. That's something I really learned. I'm actually dyslexic, so it's something that I always kind of struggled with. I always felt like, oh, maybe I'm not as good as other people, or not as something. But you know what's so cool about it is I've had the perspective now on it, because it's actually become such a gift for me, because it allows me to work with people and collaborate a lot easier, because okay. I'm aware of my deficiencies. I am more comfortable allowing people to work with me. So it has been said that I'm good, I believe, at building teams and empowering people and working with them. And even people that are way smarter than me, I'm okay with it, because I've always known, like, hey, there are things that I can't do well. So it's kind of been a gift.
Wow, yeah.
It caused me to be a very good collaborator with people. And I always have this kind of like thing where I try to unify people and get them to work together, because I see the power of people coming together and working. That's awesome. So I guess that would mean one of my gifts would be that I'm a collaborator or a team builder in that way.
Yeah, for sure.
So, and I love identifying people's strengths and seeing how they will fit together well. That'd be one of them. I don't know if work ethic is a gift necessarily.
It can be.
But that's one of my things that I just, I always feel like I have to outwork to make up for things that might be tied to my chip on my shoulder because I'm dyslexic. But that has always been such a blessing, because I'll work harder and I usually get more opportunity by working harder. Yeah. I don't know what the other gifts may be. Maybe relationships or networking.
Yeah. Well, I was definitely going to name encouragement. It sounds like, the way that you build people up and include them, and you want to find their talents and their gifts and help them, I think that's a big one. I was going to say that you have a servant's heart. You mentioned that that's what you look for in others, but I think that's because you have that.
and I love that. That's my favorite leadership style that Jesus modeled.
Yep, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And then communication. Uh-huh. You're incredibly communicative, and you're very well versed, and I don't know. It's so much fun to talk to. First of all,
yes.
But then also you know you're very eloquent and you're very. The irony that I'm not doing this very well is not lost on me. But just that you're communicating very well is what I was trying to say.
I'm glad you included that.
I speak good.
No. I speak good words.
Well, I was thinking. I hope she includes communication.
I really do love encouraging people. When you've been on a set for like 12 hours and you're cranky and things, I think that can be really be an asset. I've been told that is, I'm an exhorter. You can sometimes know your strengths by what you're not good at. Sometimes I'm not good at communicating the bad news or the hard stuff. That's where I have to work on that. That does not come easily to me. I'll tell my wife, I'm more this like the carrot rather than the stick. That's kind of my.
Yes.
That's funny.
That is funny.
Yeah.
You have this, what's the word? Utility player mindset, where it's just kind of like, again, it goes hand in hand with the servant's heart, but just that you're willing to learn and you're not afraid to try something new, and you're cool with being that utility player and like just stepping in where you see a need. And I think that's not something that everybody has.
It's also fun,
I was thinking too, this isn't necessarily a spiritual gift, but it's definitely a talent, is financial integrity. Being responsible and a good steward, not only of what God has given you, but what the Irwin brothers have trusted you with. So I just thought that, that's a hard area for people, especially when things start to become very successful.
Yeah.
Yes, it is actually really hard. And then, I'd say if loyalty is a gift, it's something at least I would hope would be something that people would say of me.
Yeah.
I thought of that.
Because I've stayed with these same guys for about 11 years, and something that I always felt part of my responsibility was to look out for them and to protect them in a way. And then when our company grew and there was more partners, I always felt like it was a big part of my job was to never be divisive between owners of the company. There's a Bible verse that talks about separators of brothers, right? And I'm so passionate about not being a separator of brothers or families or people. and to always like fight for unity. And that's not always easy because sometimes you have to say the hard thing to people, which I said, I would rather build people up than have to like,
say
the hard thing. But I've learned that like, you know, it's more loving sometimes to have the hard conversation and than it is to not, you know, and that's been a lesson I've learned. But loyalty is something that I would hope that people look back and they go, okay, he was very loyal and he was faithful, you know, and to your point, having integrity in the way that you operate with finances, it's a huge thing with investors. Yep. You know, I always kind of distrust someone who's always looking for new investors because what happened to their, you know, original investors? We've had the same group of guys for about 11 years. We don't really have a lot of new investors that come into our group sometimes. But I always, you know, the best salesman, and it's strategic as much as it's having integrity, but the best salesmen are the people that have been with you the longest. And I think that's something I look for now in people and groups of people, like who's been with them for a long time. Cause that means they've had to walk through hard stuff together and they've had to figure out how to have resolution, you know, and they've had integrity in their dealings. And we've never been sued for any kind of financial issues or never, you know, we haven't even had any really conflicts. That's something I'm really proud of because I've always had this mindset that if you have nothing to hide, then just be open with people. And especially when it comes to financial stuff, that's usually when things go kind of south is when people feel like they're not being communicated with and they don't have a full understanding. I've always just told our accountants and controllers and people I've worked with this over the years, just show it to them.
Give them the PDF.
It's very disarming when you completely just go, hey, what do you want to see? We'll show it to you. You know? And communicate back to the communication thing. That's been a big part of what I've also worked really hard on is just making sure you communicate and build relationships with people. It's such a big part of everything. Genuine relationships.
Yeah.
You know? And genuine relationships stick around when things are hard.
Yes.
Not only because we've had our, I can only imagines, but we've also had our Woodlawns, and Woodlawn taught me a ton about, cause I kind of was handed the reins to that after the fact. So I had to sometimes communicate to people when it wasn't necessarily my fault or something I did wrong, or, you know, and I had to deal with the consequences of prior people that managed things, and that no one did anything bad or anything. It just, you know, it's just when something goes, doesn't perform the way you hope it would.
Yeah.
There's really almost nothing you can say to make it better other than say something. You know, you need to say something. You need to communicate something and you need to walk through, you know. And so that was a great lesson for me. So prior to I Can Only Imagine, I had to walk through Woodlawn, which was a lot of investors who were like, this stinks. I'm not going to probably make all my money back. And I was hoping I was going to triple it, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
And you
it
have
happens.
To.
Yeah.
part of the job. It's part of taking risks. And, you know, John and Andy, to their credit, John and Andy Irwin, have always had a lot of integrity in that area. And they've always, and you know, when I started working for them, I was a kid. I was literally like 18, 19 years old.
Wow.
I got to grow up. And I was, and so I give a lot of credit to my mentors in that situation, you know, in where I'm at, because they taught me those principles that, you know, you can operate with integrity and have faith and treat people right. And, you know, I had a lot of great role models over the last 10 years.
That's awesome.
That is so cool. That's so great.
I love your journey.
This has been so inspiring.
Yeah, it really has.
So inspiring. And we are so grateful for your time. Where can folks follow you on social media?
I think it's on Instagram. It's I'm Josh Walsh.
Okay.
Or Josh W. I'm terrible at this.
Something like that.
Yeah, you can follow me on Instagram or Facebook.
Cool.
I try to comment and send emails back to people. And I have this thing I call my book ministry where I send them, if someone's interested in working in film, I'll send them like, because I have an Amazon Prime account, really doesn't cost too much. I'll send them like production books and things if they email me. So,
that's awesome.
So, but yeah, I think that's probably the best way to see my profile or follow along and send me a message. Whatever you guys want to do.
Awesome. Great. Well, Josh, thank you so much again. It was such a pleasure to meet you and chat with you. You're just so generous. That's another gift I'm going to share with you, is that you just obviously are very generous with your knowledge and your time and your gift, which is very cool. And we are very grateful.
Thank you so much. I have had a great time.
Thanks. You.
Anytime you want me to.
Yes, we did it. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
For more information on Project Brickworks, visit us online at projectbrickworks.org. Subscribe to our newsletter or text BRICK to 55498 to get the latest news and updates. We love y'all. Be blessed, and we'll see you next time.